Awesome to welcome youth hockey director, coach developer for USA Hockey, Jim Haverstrom, to the Basketball Podcast. Jim is dedicated youth hockey director and coach developer with USA Hockey, boasting over 25 years of hands-on experience in youth sports that began as a volunteer coach for his son's team in Orlando, Florida. With a degree from the University of Kansas, Jim has built a 20-plus year career focused on player development, serving as a trainer for the Positive Coach Alliance and as player safety coordinator for USA Hockey's Southeast District from 2020 to 2025. His expertise lies in designing high-quality practices that emphasize puck touches, decision-making, and fun.
Hey, Coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable, and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Jim, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Hey, I'm pretty excited to actually be with basketball guys. I'm usually with hockey guys.
I'm excited to have you. I've followed you for a long time. Really enjoy a lot of the sharing that you put out into the universe. And we're going to talk about it. We can have hockey stories. We can have basketball stories. It's all good. We're talking about coaching with a focus on how to coach more than what to coach. And maybe just first for our audience, frame a little bit of where you are in this space in hockey.
Right now, I work with a program where I train their youngest players, their 8Us, and I coach one of their 10U teams. And then I work with coaching the coaches. And that also goes on what I also do. I'm a coach developer for USA Hockey. And the group of coaches that I'm with, or coach developers I'm with, we probably train close to 3,000 coaches this year through the USA Hockey Education Program.
That's tremendous. And coaching the coaches is a big part of what I try and do. And certainly my role with the NBA and with Nike is to be able to evolve that a little bit. So you're a great role model for me to be able to learn what you're doing and how you're doing it. So maybe let's start. Where is hockey in this space right now?
Hockey's still growing with this in this space. Now, the European countries have been pretty far ahead of us in some ways, like Finland and Sweden. They've been jumped on board with some of the stuff maybe sooner than we did as a whole federation, because being the size of their countries, the federation has a little bit more control over the coaching because there's not as widespread an area. But USA Hockey has jumped on totally on board with this. In our education program, we have four levels. Actually five, but we have four that they're required to take over a four-year span. And we are pushing ecological dynamics. We stay away from certain words, but we use constraints-led approach. We show how we use that. The idea of our curriculum is based on, just like you said, how to coach, not what to coach. How we want to get kids to learn how to become decision makers. How should we teach technique? How to avoid isolated training when possible. Make it so that it's transferable to the game and not just make cones players.
Cones is a great segue. I grew up playing hockey in Canada, a tremendous experience, obviously a lot of knowledgeable people. But what I remember a lot is cones and skating through cones with a puck and shooting on a goal with no goalie. And then since then, with my daughters in different types of youth sports, I've seen the same thing replicated over and over again in soccer in particular. And I remember my daughter coming to me after one practice and just saying, "This is no fun. We're not playing soccer." And that's a big part of it, isn't it? And I know that's a big part of your space, is connecting it to fun for players.
Yeah, like I said, with the program I'm with, I run our 8Us and I train one of the 10U teams. We have very few cones in either of them. Very often when we use cones, it's either to outline an area, or I play some games where we may not have a goalie, but we set up different gates where they're playing a game and whoever gets it has to skate through that gate. So this way, if my goalies are training with something like that, we can still do game-oriented drills, or I'd rather call them activities, because when I think of activities now, it's active participation and learning by the learner. So as opposed to, this is where you go, this is how you turn. And the kids love it. I also think a big part of it is, especially with my 10U team, we keep score. I went out and bought this little scoreboard so they can see the lights, and they go berserk over this scoreboard. They want to know who's winning, who's not, because now they're competing, they're learning, they're enjoying it. Sometimes they don't even know what they're learning, but as you can see, as it starts to apply to the game, where they start looking for open spaces, they start using their body, they start using the skating techniques they've been working on, but in a skillful manner, not just being able to go around a cone. They make a turn because that's what they're supposed to do. They stop because that's what they're supposed to do, as opposed to go to a cone, stop here, come back here, stop there, where you can plan the technique as opposed to having to be perform it under a game like pressure.
Less predetermined solutions. So they have to figure out solutions. And that's what you're trying to stimulate. I want to go to the fun piece there, because I know you and I have both dealt with many resistors in our time. And one of the resistances is like, well, you just want this to be just frivolous fun. And I'm like, no, competing is fun. Getting better is fun. Playing hockey to get better at hockey is fun. Just like playing basketball to get better at basketball is fun. So talk to us a little bit about that component. You already mentioned the competition piece, that they love knowing the score and they love competing for the score.
One of the people that work for the National Office of USA Hockey, a woman named Heather Mannix, and she's actually been involved with these fun maps. And it's fun isn't screwing around. Fun may not even be smiling. It's learning something new. It's trying to something I've never done before. It's competing. It's all these parts that people think are frivolous when they hear the word fun is frivolous, but it's not a four-letter word. It is a it. If the kids aren't having fun, at least in my mind, if they're not having fun at practice, why would they go home and practice away from the rink? And I think that's a huge part of it, because as you know, Chris, kids don't just get good at practice. The really good ones get practice at home. And why would they bother if it's, oh, I got to go to hockey again? It's like, they want to get better. So they try harder and they try new things. And if we put them in a supportive environment, then they're willing to fail and get better at what they're doing. And we always just let them go. And no, we do coach them, but we coach them by putting them in environments. We give them feedback. We don't just say go play, but we try to set up environments that or working on a technique. If I want to work on tight turns, why don't I put them in a puck battle in the corner where they're forced to make tight turns? And I may not use a puck, I may use a ringette, which is that little ring, I'm sure you as a Canadian know it, so they can keep their head up. I watch kids, they have fun playing ringette, and I see kids make skating maneuvers that I didn't think they were capable of, because now they're reacting to what they see, as opposed to, oh, I got to turn here or I got to turn there. And they're concentrating on that turn, as opposed to, I see it, I have to react to it, and I do it.
I love that. That's a great example of constraints-led approach. And coaches get fearful hearing these terms, ecological dynamics, constraints-led. I always connect it for at least basketball coaches in the sense that when analytics first started in basketball, three's worth more than two, and all this different math that has come up, people were fearful of it and they just poo-pooed it a little bit. But now almost every coach can speak that. I imagine it's going to be the same for this type of language. And to a certain extent, you're seeing it in your coach education programs already, aren't you?
Yeah, we have a section we work on observation, and it's using the CLA to observe. So we set up these off-ice games where these coaches are playing these different off-ice games, and we have to observe it. But then we talk about, okay, what are the constraints doing? What is this constraint creating in this game? What constraints could we change? Can we make this thing bigger? Can we make it smaller? How the use of putting two nets in this game now causes direction. And so we're sneaking in CLA under the guise of, hey, let's work on our observational techniques.
Oh, I love that approach. That's such a great approach. And one of the things that I'm sure you've got the most feedback on is your reference to the Hockey Canada study. And I want you to share that with everyone about a well-designed practice. Because when I've shared this with people, first of all, they can't believe it. And then secondly, they can't believe it.
Yeah, it's always been the idea of play games. But let's say I take my 10U team to a game. We play three 13-minute periods. I have three lines. So the kids get on there for 13 minutes a game. But in a well-structured practice, the situations that can happen in the game can be 15 to 20 times more than they'll actually see in a game. My practices are totally so all the situations arise way more often. Plus, if I've got a team of, let's say, 15 players, I'm cutting them in two. So now they're even getting more repetitions than they would if it was like the 15 kids going through that hour practice. And since we set them up with the constraints are working on things that I see that they need to work on in the game. And we're not creating their solutions, we're just guiding them to possible solutions. And what I found the most exciting about all of this is they come up with solutions I never thought of, because they're basing it off of the player that they are, not the player that I may have been or the player that I envision them to be. And I don't want them to solve the problems all the same, because they're not the same problems and that same people. Like in your world, a 7 foot center and a 6 foot guard don't need to solve the problems the same way. So why should I expect that in hockey? Yet we tend to. And that's where that cones thing comes in. I want you to do this and this. And in our world, I look at it. I remember a couple of years ago, I went to a Lightning game. Nikita Kucherov is one of the most creative players in the NHL. And I watched him get his 100th assist. And he did it a certain way where he slows the game down. That same year, Connor McDavid, who is a superstar, had his 100th assist. And in that same situation, Connor would have sped up the game, not slowed it down, but they both got 100 assists. So why pigeonhole kids into this is the way you need to solve the problem?
And let's go deeper down that, because that's such a great point. Is so much of these non-negotiables, these musts that you must play off at 2 feet, for example, in basketball, they sound great in terms of cookie cutter, but it's like the reality is every player is different. And so talk to us a little bit more about how we create that environment to be able to afford for these individual differences.
Again, they're solving a problem. So if it's a passing game, or it's a game that's geared towards, let's say in our game, net front presence is a big thing where guys get in front of the net and they battle for loose pucks. If I have a big, strong kid, he may stand in front of the net and battle back and forth. If I have a kid who is smaller or he's not as physically strong, he can create that same screen by skating back and forth and not being involved in this one-on-one battle that he most likely is going to lose and not be effective at. Or he may stay a little further away from the defender and screen from further away. They're both solving the problem based off their individual constraints. And I think that's where we run into an issue with coaches don't think of the player's individual constraints and how that affects how they should play the game. I even look at my own boys. I have one who's 6'1". And they all played hockey. One played college hockey. And then I had another one, my middle son, who played college hockey, was like 5'11", really fast, really technically proficient. And then my younger son was really smart hockey player, but he wasn't big and strong, yet he could still win puck battles because he knew how to use his body. And his other brothers would solve that puck. The other one would come in and be so fast and quick and agile, he'd be out of there. And the other one is 6'1", could just go in and battle because of his size. So all three of them could win or solve that problem, but they all had to do it differently based off of who they were physically and also personality-wise.
So, such powerful stuff to be able to think about it that way. And I hope coaches are starting to think about things that way. You mentioned the connection between obviously having fun, the version we talked about, playing the game, and seeing possibilities for you as a young athlete in particular to be able to inspire you to be able to go work on your game. That's the biggest thing for me, is that if they go to practice and they're playing hockey and they're playing basketball, they see why they can go work on their shot, as opposed to, hey, never shoot because we're running this pattern offense and we're going to work on defense 80% of the practice, for example. So help coaches understand you create this game-based practice, for lack of a better way I'll call that. What are you doing then to help them when they go work on their stuff on their own?
We point out why we're doing everything. So it's not, hey, we're going to play a game. It's like we talk about the game. This is what we're focusing on. Because this year, all of a sudden, halfway through the season, I ended up taking over a 16 team due to a coaching change. And I literally bring almost the same practice I have at 10U to them, because the crazy thing is, and I see it all the time, is even at 16, they have some of the same issues that they do at 10. It just happens a lot faster. So I, especially with them, I will talk about, hey, We need better net front presence. We need to get battle to that area of the ice. And so the games are set up where they're almost forced to battle and do these things. So now they know, okay, for me, I'm going to have to work on this to be able to get to this ice. I'm going to have to maybe work on puck protection better. I can, or I need to, my older guys had this problem where they do what we call dusting off the puck, where when they got the puck, instead of shooting it right away, they'd go back and forth with it. So I made a rule in one of the games that you can't use the back part of your stick. And so now they had to just shoot it pretty quickly off the blade. So now that's something they go home and they practice. And I noticed it was way better. Their technical ability was way better the next practice for some of them because they went home and they practiced that. They knew what to practice on. And I also told them too, if you do practice at home, I don't want you to try to repeat it perfectly. I want you to be off balance. I want you to use different parts of your blade. I want you to not try to make it perfect, but like in your world, adaptable. Because coming from your world, I remember listening to a lot of basketball podcasts because we all listen to all different sports, and they talk about how an NBA player can shoot 80% threes or whatever in practice. And in the game, if you can shoot 40, you're like a superstar. So it's not that perfect squared up because that doesn't happen all the time. So let's practice adaptability where maybe the release point's the same, but we get there a different way. And also, I find that when the kids go home and practice that way, they don't get as bored because now they're trying different things as opposed to, oh, I got to take 100 shots like this. Oh, that wasn't perfect. Oh, that wasn't the right way. I'm not trying to make them perfect. I'm just trying to make them help them become adaptable.
Engagement and entertainment. That's part of the deal for sure. So I love that connection. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned that drop off from practice to game shooting percentage, and it's a real thing for sure. But it's also something that I feel ecological coaches, CLA coaches account for with their players when we explain to them the fact that they're not going to perform as well as if they did these blocked traditional drills where they're going to see the ball go in and over again. And that's something that I explain immediately to players if they've never trained with me or practiced with me before, is you're going to struggle, and that's good because that's learning. So talk to us a little bit about creating that kind of optimal environment for mindset and for development.
Like you said, if they're not struggling, they're not really learning. I had the situation in practice actually on Tuesday. I introduced some new games to my 10-year-old team, and it was ugly. It was really ugly. But then you start to see all of a sudden, wow, this kid just got that. This kid just did that. And I looked over to my assistant that night and I said, parents are going to think that this is terrible, that we're awful. If we did this perfectly, why would we be doing this? There's no learning involved. So, yes, they struggled, but since it was a game, they didn't have the time to sit back and go, oh, that was bad. They were right on to the very next thing, and they could start to see the improvement. And anytime there was improvement of any kind, we made a point to let them know that, hey, I saw that. So, yes, I struggled, but when I got it, coach saw that. And he wasn't harping on what I didn't get. It was, oh, he saw me doing it right.
I think we're both obsessed with being practical and applicable in our coaching. So, can you give us one of the drills, for example, that you did yesterday that you introduced? Give us the name of it. What was one?
We just called it a quick up drill. And
Perfect.
basically, it was it's simple wording. They understand it. So the next time we do it, they'll know exactly. And then if we do move it to a larger area, I'll call it a quick up half ice drill, or I'll call it a quick up full ice drill. So they get it. And I had somebody tell me something once that I thought was really smart. If you can't write out the drill on the back of a napkin, it's probably too complicated. So I never use the whiteboard anymore. It took me a little while to get my skills better at being able to describe what we were doing, but I figured if I can't describe it to a 10-year-old, drawing on a board is not going to help. And it gets actually the person who gets more frustrated is me because you saw it, you told me what you needed to do, but then you couldn't do it. Instead, we'll make sure we do the best job we can describing it, and then we work on asking questions that will show that they understand it, but also knowing that just because they can tell us what to do doesn't mean that they, when they first get out there, will be able to do it. And with our USA Hockey training, we actually have a thing on explanations, but we make a big point that the explanation is great, but the questions is almost more important. And when I teach that section, I always try to emphasize that usually as coaches, we do a really good job planning our explanation, but we don't plan our questions. And then we all know what question we come up with is, do you understand? And they all say yes, and it's a cluster.
Love that. So this quick up drill, take us through it. So you're going to introduce the drill. So let's go practically into this. So you've got them there. How is Jim introducing this drill? And then what are you doing after you've introduced the drill?
Okay, we'll obviously bring them in, making sure that we're having eye contact with them because, especially at 9 years old, they're all over the place. But you give them a couple seconds, and then we'll explain that, hey, we're going to play a 3-on-3 game, nets on both sides. We're going to draw a line down the middle. It's two on, or it's two, actually, I'm sorry, it wasn't 3-on-3. It was 2-on-2 in both zones. When the defense gets the puck, they've got to move it to their offensive players in the other zone. If the offensive players get it, then they can go and score. And then, just like that, if the other team's defense gets it, they pass it up to their offense and they get it. And then I'll ask questions about, like, why will we be doing this? We want to score goals. So, yes, we do. But we also want to make sure our defense makes plays so the puck doesn't come right back at us. And I always say to them, is it fun playing in our zone? And they always go, no. So, what do we have to do that? Oh, we have to get opens for passes. And so there's a brief discussion. And then once the actual game starts, then as I always make sure that personally, I don't dump pucks in because that means I'm active in the drill as opposed to being able to observe, go around and talk to a kid. And I'll ask if I see a kid just throw the puck away, we'll go up and say, what did you see? Okay. Did you see your other opponent on the other side? No. Okay, well, that's okay. So next time, that's something we can look for. So we don't ram it down the throats. Get your head up. It's okay. Now I know you didn't see him. So now it helps me as a coach. And so we'll go through all these different as they go through, and we'll let kids know I saw you do this. If they did that really well, hey, you had some different options. Why did you pick that one? And they do give you pretty good answers. As long as they're not in there too long, then they even forget what you're talking about. And if they do say that, I don't remember, okay, that's all right. And then we'll just talk about something you can see, but we don't get angry at them. And even if the same kid does the same thing over and over again, it's okay. So what can I do to help you get better at this? I'm not saying we don't get frustrated because we're human beings, but we realize that they're still kids. And same with my 16 team is we have to almost approach it the same way because otherwise they're going to cave. It's they want to know when they do it right. They want to understand that, hey, it's a chaotic game. I may not see everything. And they also, especially at that age, want to know, how am I going to help them? And that's what I'm there for.
So I'm here for this, like this deep dive into kind of coaches understanding exactly what this looks like. You're teaching the activity basically with as little information as possible to get them to be able to do the activity. You let them do the activity. And then most of what you just talked about in terms of feedback is individual feedback. It's mini conversations with individual players rather than big group stopping and break group things. Is that a fair
Yeah.
part? Yeah.
I very rarely stop the group. What I will do, and I got this from Rob Gray, was the idea of what do you do next? So if the game is going a certain way and I'm not seeing these kind of situations, I may adapt the game and then I'll stop the game and say, hey, we're going to add this or we're going to take away that. For example, with my 16 team playing that same game, they tend to play around the perimeter instead of attacking the net. So the way it's set up cross ice is the face-off circles are in front of where the nets are. And the constraint I added was all shots must come inside that circle. So now they had to fight to that area. A lot of times I don't make where it's only this or that. I may incentivize it with points. But with these guys, I really needed to get them to the net. And so that way they were like, also, I was watching, like when my assistant goes, did you see that? He was 2 feet outside the circle and he took that extra step to get in there. It's like, yep. And so we can change the game, but not necessarily stop everything to say, hey, you should go there, that you should go there, that kind of stuff.
So that's how you account for a little bit of the struggle. Maybe you need to task simplify it a little bit so they get the point with it.
Hey, Coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you really know which plays, sets, and actions are working for your team? On offense, how valuable are paint touches and post entries? On defense, do you get more stops playing man or zone? Like high-level college and pro teams, you can use an analytics system like Hoopsalytics to get data-driven answers to help guide your in-game strategy and practice emphasis. With Hoopsalytics, you can track any action or set and see the resulting points per possession. Plus the video link stats, you can view your successes and fails and see if it's a play design or execution issue. And you can easily build organized film sessions from these video clips. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free.
What I'm curious about, and this is what I get asked a lot, and I'm not sure about you, where is the place for direct instruction? Is there a place for explicit instruction at any point?
I think so. It's just, I try to avoid, if I'm working with a player technically, now, again, I prefer having an opposition to different things. But there are some times when you are working with an individual. So I may work on a technique, but instead of telling them what their body should do, in a sense, I'll just say to them, hey, like there's a thing called walking the blue line where the defenseman walks, moves along the blue line to take a shot. I'll just tell them, I want you to look at the net the whole time. And now they all of a sudden they start working on their footwork, their hips and stuff like that, to get up so they're facing the net, and they start using the techniques I want them to use, as opposed to telling them, I want your hip out like this, I want you like that. Or if I'm working on their stride, I may, because a lot of times players have a thing where they call railroading, where they don't shift their weight and their legs stay out. I'll just tell them when they push out, I want you to keep the skate blade, as much of the skate blade on the ice as possible. What that does is tends to put them in the right position, but they're not thinking of their body. They're just thinking of that blade being in the ice. It's direct, but without being, I want you to bend your knee this much, or I want you to flex. It tends to happen, but it's more about them experimenting with that kind of thing. I know, I guess like in basketball, say, hey, you have to have your wrist a certain way. You've got to have your elbow at a certain place. As opposed to, I've heard like people say, instead of reach to the and put the cup away in the cupboard, that kind of stuff, where it's direct in a sense, but it's not telling you exactly what to do.
Yeah, external versus internal cues kind of thing, right? Like extend your ladder is something I always said to my daughters when they shoot. Extend the ladder, not telling them, hey, listen, you must have this degree on your follow through or something like that.
Yeah.
Allow for adaptability in this process. That's really the main thing.
And I think it's really important too, when you're working with young players, really make sure it's very adaptable, because as they go, and this is another reason why I really love teaching through a game-like approach, is that as they grow, their technique's going to have to change anyway. And as they get through puberty, there's going to be a drastic change in their technique. But if I'm focusing on the same time them learning how to play the game, that's not going to change through puberty. Those concepts or those will be there no matter how their technique changes, because now they're understanding how the game is played. They're starting to look for those things. Those things may change due to their internal constraints, their own constraints now. But why carry a protractor out on the ice to make sure he's got a 90 degree angle when his shin's going to be a totally different length when he's 13? So it's, yes, we're going to work on principles. But you're literally, that poor child is changing weekly. So why do we get so ingrained that it has to be just like that? And then they hit puberty and it's all different. So adaptability, just like you said, adaptable technique is what we're looking for, not precise, repeatable technique.
And what you're bringing up is that as coaches, so many of us bring our bias into the coaching situation. This is what my coach did. This is what worked for me. And you're not accounting for the fact that every individual is different, clearly, which we've talked about, but also just that open-mindedness in being able to create a safe space for players to be able to show you something that's maybe you never thought of. And that's beautiful. And that to me is what comes back to, and I want you to talk about this, the power of creating a practice that's designed more for decision-making than the application of a specific technique.
One of the things that drives me crazy with social media, for example, is I will see this explanation for this drill that I'm going to see that says they're working on deception. And they come in and they fake out a cone. How do you know whether you deceived anyone? Now, I'm not saying they're not working on a certain technique or whatever like that, but how do you know if that movement would make another player fake that other player out? You don't know that. Yet they come back with this false sense of accomplishment. And then what I found is a lot of players that train that way will actually get too close to the defenders in the actual game. It's like they have been trained to go to the defender as opposed to evade the defender. So by setting up the games, it's pretty quick feedback whether or not you deceive somebody, because either they knock the puck off your stick or they get in your way, they get in the way of your pass. So the game gives feedback. And if we want to work on deception, we can one-on-one deception, we can have one-on-one games. You can have two-on-two. A lot of times in hockey, we try to get at least two-on-two. So you have the player with the puck, the player without the puck, the player defending the puck, and the player away from the puck. But again, depending on your situation with and the circumstances of the practice, you can do one-on-one type things too. So if we make everything decision-making based, then the technique they're working on is based on the game. So whether or not I'm going to make a half of a crossover, am I going to make a half of a tight turn? Am I just going to make a quick 1 foot stop as opposed to, you know, what we always see kids going to the line and making a 2 foot stop. It's the technique is based off of the decision that they see. And are they going to make mistakes? Heck yeah. But the feedback is pretty quick by what happens in the game. They don't always need me to tell them that was wrong.
The example you brought up is powerful because, again, we see it in basketball training culture all the time is do a move on air, no defense, no decisions, and then put them in a game situation and just say, oh, nobody ever holds them accountable to doing that move because they know ultimately it's like you've got to make a decision based on perception and decision within the game environment. So I think to your point and my point is why not just start with that? And that's what coaches have a hard time with. They can't play basketball before they have pivoting technique or they have passing technique or stuff like that. You and I have both done it where new players that have never played a sport before can literally go play basketball or hockey, right? Because it's a principle of play more than it is an application of a technique.
Like I said, I work a lot with our 8Us. We play a lot of ringette and the techniques that they're using or even the passing plays they start making because their eyes are up and they don't feel constrained to look down to the puck yet is amazing. Now, some people say, well, that's not playing hockey. It's teaching them the skating techniques and the understanding and the body techniques. I got to get my shoulder in here. I got to get in front. And I watch kids do these very, what would be considered advanced skating techniques that literally, if I told them to skate up to the cone to do it, they couldn't do it. But because that was the only way to get away or to open up, they do it because they see it. It's like kids going outside and playing. They'll do all sorts of things because I remember listening on a podcast where a guy was a PE teacher and he's talking about how his daughter couldn't skip and it was driving him crazy till he looked out the window and she skipped down the hill because that's the way it was to go down the hill as opposed to trying to make her skip.
Love that example. That's such a good one. I have so many curious thoughts here, but let's go. You mentioned the eyes, the importance of the eyes a few times. So talk to us about scanning. Because again, a lot of the stuff that I learned about scanning came from other sports than basketball. And a lot of the research and particularly soccer that have done a great job with expanding our understanding of scanning.
Well, what's really neat is I'm not privy to all the information yet, but USA Hockey is doing a deep dive into scanning. And they're, what's neat is the federations between the Finnish, the Swedish, and US are very collaborative. They're not like trying to hold onto it. They're just trying to make the game better. And I think the Canadian, I think Canada's getting involved with some of these scanning studies too. It's like, how many times does a player scan? How many times, and what do they look for? One of the things that used to happen, like in practices, and I know I even did it because hopefully I'm getting better every day too, and not doing some of the things I used to. You dump the puck in, defenseman would pick it up, we tell him to shoulder check, and then they'd make a pass to somebody on the boards. And then you start to realize that they don't, they're not, they're just turning their head. It's like a kid just turning his head and then walking into the street because they don't know what to look for. So we'll make sure, or at least I will now, that I have token pressure. The pressure may be 15 feet away, but at least they're looking. And then you ask questions like, was the player a right-handed shot or a left-handed shot? Well, I don't know. Does that make a difference? Yeah, probably, because where his stick's going to be is going to affect where I might pass. And if you make it so the kid's far enough away, he's got that time to look for that. But again, that's where coaching comes in, where what things should I look for? You start, and I had done stuff before where I'd stand there and I'd take my stick and I'd go like this and I'd go like that for them to look at. And I realized it's better than nothing, but that's not the relevant cues that he needs to be looking for. And then, like, you hit it on the nose, you scale it. And then you have maybe more defenders or more offensive players that he has to look for with maybe a little less pressure, but then you amp it up so that it gets more game-like. But that's the thing I get with kids. We want to try to get them to be willing to lose the puck, willing to, just so that instead that they look and question them when they come back. And as I said earlier, I want to know if they saw it or they didn't see it. Because a lot of people say, oh, kids are puck hogs. No, they don't see it yet. So what can we do in our practices, or what can I do to help them? And the great players scan better. And it's not necessarily they always scan more. They pick up more relevant information quicker than the average player. But have we done that for our kids? Most of the time, it's if you're going around a cone, you're not scanning. So I always look at that's an opportunity for them not to learn. Why don't we put them in something where at least we can work on something similar to what you're doing there, but they at least have to be scanning and looking around and finding open ice, those kinds of things.
I love it. Accounting for scanning is such a powerful thing for coaches to understand moving forward if they're not doing it already. You mentioned don't get angry, and obviously frustration and all that's normal. We're human, so we want people to do better and we want people to get better. But saying that, I find the hardest part about coaching actually holding players accountable to doing better. And we're not saying don't coach them, right? We're saying it's okay to tell them, hey, listen, you can do something better. So can you help us understand how to frame that for a player to help them understand that they can do better at something?
I think that's really important. I'm also a trainer for Positive Coaching Alliance. And with PCA, it's not about everything is wonderful, all that kind of stuff. It's we want you to be the best athlete you can. We will hold you accountable as a coach. And something just as powerful as saying to a kid, you're better than that, can really turn a kid around, because what that's also saying to him is, no, you're not be giving your all, but I believe in you as a coach that you are better than that, that you have the ability to get there. And a lot of it's like you do hold them accountable is, okay, did you try hard that time? Were you working at your best? And if they come back and say, no, okay. Then you start even asking questions like, why are you having a hard day? It was like school bad today. When I'm dealing with 16-year-old boys, it's like, it could be their girlfriend told them to take a hike that day. And it's like the last thing they want to do is play hockey. Or a lot of the stress on these older kids about going, oh, have I done 50 community service hours because I've got to do it for college and all this stuff, is maybe asking them, what's going on? How can I help you? As opposed to thinking they're lazy. And what I've also found too, and I'm sure you've run into it, sometimes kids we think that are lazy are just terrified of making a mistake. So if I don't go get the puck, if I don't go get the ball, I can't screw up. But we perceive that as laziness. It's that lack of confidence. So that's where our questioning, I think, can help us keep them more accountable. But as well as I do, that a well-run practice keeps them going. My favorite thing to hear from kids, like, and I've been hearing it from my 16 team because they did not have the same. I'm not saying I'm a better coach than they had, but my practices were all game-like. I keep hearing from the kids, don't blow the whistle yet. Do we get at least one more turn? So that kind of helps push them to want to be work harder because they're enjoying what they're doing.
It's such a powerful thing to be able to create that environment where they don't look at the clock, they don't know what the time is, because they don't care, because they're just immersed in the experience of playing, of competing, of getting better. And thank you for framing that. Yes, you can coach them, and yes, we want to coach them. And that's the other part of it, is that sometimes I think coaches think within this CLA ecological framework that we're not accounting for mental toughness and intensity and these different things that kind of lead to mindset training. My view, and I'd love to hear yours, is we're actually accounting for it more because they're actually playing the game and they're experiencing struggle and success and challenges within the game. So it's more likely to transfer. But talk to us about how you're developing mindset within these drills.
Part of it too is I really like to keep score, and we have winners and losers, and I don't make kids skate. I
I was
don't
going to
make
say,
them
do you have
skate themselves.
consequences?
I do have consequences, but they're sometimes be fun consequences. One of the ones that drives them crazy is if we'll play all the games, the winner at the end of the night has to untie the skates of the other team. They cannot stand to do that
People that
because
don't
it's
know
like,
hockey don't appreciate how annoying that is.
yeah, or it'll be like, okay, you got to carry all the other guys' sticks off the ice. Or as you know from hockey too, you get a lot of snow on your sticks. You got to clean the snow off the other team's sticks. And it's nothing like punitive, but they hate it. They truly hate the fact that so it gives them that another incentive to win or lose. And but also, what I will do at times is, yeah, a team will lose. I will point out plays by the team that lost that were exceptional. That, hey, I know you guys, this team won, but did you see such and such do this? Did you see how that can like that? They were behind and they battled to the very end. So it's not just rewarding the winning team with compliments, it's still finding positives and some exceptional plays by the team that lost. And so they don't always feel that I only care about them if they win.
And also, obviously, losing is a part of the game and it's a part of
Yeah.
life and it's a part of failure and all that stuff. And you've created that kind of environment where they can learn it, they can learn to overcome it, and they can learn to manage it as well. Just like learning to manage how to win, both of those are part of the process, aren't they?
And we try to manage their emotion. So what I find, or what I think I even did when I used to practice, is I tried to avoid emotional moments because I don't want things to get out of whatever you don't want. You want a nice, clean practice. So sometimes we do unfair things. We won't make a call that's a penalty, or we'll call a penalty that's not there, so that they learn to manage their emotions. They get a chance to practice managing emotions so that when the game comes, it's not the first time they have to handle it. Or we'll constantly, if it's a game, we'll throw the puck to one team more often than the other. And you can see them start to get frustrated. And then it's let's deal with it. What are you going to do about it? And so they start, no, are they going to struggle with it? Of course. But now we're giving them a chance to practice emotions, just like technique, just like game sense, so that when Saturday and Sunday hits and the call's not their way, they are better able to handle it. And it doesn't matter whether they're 9, 8, or 16, emotions become a big part of the game that not only helps them grow as hockey players, but as human beings. And I think my PCA training really focuses on the idea that they are human beings first. The Swedish and Finnish hockey federations, the very first thing they talk about is the human. Then they go into the player.
Spent some time in Sweden and they really have some unique approaches to that human aspect for sure. And maybe in some cases, like for Americans, they would consider it extreme, but somewhere in the middle probably lies the truth to somewhat to be able
Yeah.
to push and challenge, but at the same time, be able to create a environment where they feel safe and they feel like they belong. And that's really the art of this, isn't it?
And we want them to understand that they are kids that play hockey, not just hockey players. Now, and I know what it's like. My middle son had two hip operations in college, and that ended his college career. And he was devastated because I remember even myself, I tell people that's my son, the hockey player. I have a son who's a doctor, and I always say my son, the doctor, because that's like kind of cool. But it was devastating for him to lose that identity. And I had a PCA workshop with a girls' softball team yesterday, and I stressed that you are girls that play softball. Softball is very meaningful for you, and I understand that, but that is not your total identity. You are this, you are that. And I think that stress that we put on kids that my son, the hockey player, or my daughter, the hockey player, isn't necessarily fair to them. And because then when they aren't successful, it's I'm letting people down. I'm losing my identity. I'm not gonna, and they start comparing themselves with other people, not thinking the fact that their journey, every player's journey is different.
Such a great point. Kids remind me all the time that it's not necessarily their goal to play Division I basketball. It's not necessarily their goal to play in the NBA or WNBA. That's not necessarily their goal. They just are playing sport. They're in the present, and that's all that matters for them. And that's obviously a powerful part to understand. What's one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring coach who's, again, older coach, younger coach, doesn't matter, but who's moving into this domain, shifting from, say, traditional rigid coaching to more dynamic approach that we're talking about?
I think the most important thing is allowing yourself to fail. You're going to design
That's
some
really
really
hard for
bad
coaches,
stuff.
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you pick a drill out of a book, this is the drill. You know everything about it. But being willing to design environments that aren't going to be good and then tell the players, this is on me. This is bad. So you show them accountability. And then the other part that comes after that is, like I said, what Rob Gray said is, what do you do next? You can start off with a framework of a game, and it can last 25 minutes if you are keeping changing different aspects or constraints of it to, I want to say, manipulate the game, but to adapt the game to what you're seeing. So don't feel bad about that. Oh, well, I only played this game. Yeah, but there was like nine different things you were able to go through as the game adapted. And not, and the third part of it is too, is anytime you're playing a game, there's offense and defense. So obviously both things are happening, but you got to focus on one is the big observation points. You see the other stuff, but if you start talking about the offensive part and then you start talking about the defense and the offensive defense, they get confused. But the beauty of this is better probably than me is then you just play that game again and you emphasize the defense. So it's just how you emphasize and what you're observing and
That's
explaining.
super advice. That's very practical advice for sure. Is that, and again, I you paint the picture, I paint the picture. It's non-linear. It's not going to happen all in one game, one practice, one drill, one activity anyways. Account for that in terms of those things. Jim, another part of this is how to account for the coach that's moving and shifting and doing that. But a big piece for, I'm sure, what you're doing too is like educating parents about what they're seeing, because often it looks quite different than what their perception of hockey practice or basketball practice is.
It's neat that you asked that question because we actually have part of that in our USA Hockey coaching education. What do you tell parents who see this for the first time? And I think for a long time, it used to be the idea that I'm the coach, you're the parent, you bring your kid to practice, I run practice, and you leave me alone. I'm the expert. But we have to remember that those children are those biggest, the most important people in those parents' life. So they want to know what's going on. They come with biases that that's not the way I did it. I watched a pro practice, and this is the way pro players do it. Why aren't we doing this? Or I saw this organization that's successful, and they do it that way. They have the best players. That's not necessarily the training that's helping them. We want to educate our parents. Like last night, I was doing something on my 16 team. I sent a thing to my parents. This is what we're working on. So they don't think we were just playing games. They don't think that if I didn't think that I was teaching this, the game is showing them this. This is something I noticed in game watching our games that we need to get better at. This is what we did. This may look ugly tonight, but if it was perfect, like we talked about, they're not learning. So we're gonna repeat this so that they start to feel more comfortable in these situations. What I always try to tell these the coaches in the coaching clinic for USA Hockey is that we do not want to create a vacuum. A vacuum of information is going to be filled by someone else. And the nature of a vacuum is a vacuum sucks. So we don't want to have that kind of situation where somebody else is jumping in because their kid's the best player on the team and say, such and such, do it this way. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And I'm really, truly not trying to influence or swing all the parents to my side because I don't think that's ever possible. I always have a group of parents who, no matter what I do, will say that's right. I have a group of parents that may never agree with me. It can be just one parent, two parents, but I'm really trying to work on those parents that are in the middle so they don't get swayed one way or the other. And I owe it to them to inform them. I heard something again last night that the team will go on without me, but without a team, I can't coach. So I owe it to them. They're bringing their kids, they're paying money. Why are we doing this way? And
most parents are professionals, or they have a job, or they have something where they have their own expertise. And I think generally they appreciate when you share your expertise with them too, because you've studied this and they haven't.
When I start a new season, and I'm not trying to do it to brag to them or anything, I say, I've been on four or five podcasts. Here are my podcasts if you want to listen to them to see what my approach is. And that through the season, I'll talk with you. I'll send you emails or texts as to what we're doing. I will talk to you about what we're doing because that's my job. My job is to help you understand what we're doing with your kids, because you deserve to know. And I know a lot of coaches who don't want to, and I understand that. They're busy and stuff. They don't want the confrontation. But as I explained to the coaches in these clinics, you avoid a lot of those problems just by letting them know. And again, if they don't agree with you, at least they know why you're doing it, as opposed to he's just standing there while they play games.
Jim, now you have another podcast to share with them.
Exactly.
It's great. It's great. And listen, I can't thank you enough for sharing the game with us and sharing your knowledge. And your social media is a great example of just sharing different opinions and adding value to coaching as a whole without being confrontational, without telling people they're wrong. We're presenting information that has been studied and has been experientially applied for a very long time now. And really do appreciate that perspective. Thanks for sharing with us.
I'm excited to be on a basketball podcast. And it's fun. I listen to a lot of basketball podcasts, including your own. And it's neat to see how different sports are starting to embrace these concepts.
I imagine you're the same as me, like to a certain extent. And I know we're going to keep going here, but look, because you're coaching principles of play and because you're focused on how to teach, an invasion sport is an invasion sport. I could step into a hockey or a rugby practice and I could help players seek and find space and figure out advantages and disadvantages and do things like that. And that's something that's really powerful in your coaching, because it means you are adaptable in different environments, especially when it comes to basketball, different teams, different environments, et cetera. That's a part of this too, isn't it?
It is, because like you said, invasion sports are invasion sports. Now, we have a goalie who protects our net, but you have a 7-foot monster that protects your net. So it's same idea as finding open, supporting each other, finding open areas, having your head up, using adaptable technique, whether it's soccer, whether it's lacrosse. There's so many similarities that we can all learn from each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful coaching community. Thanks for being a part of it.
Yeah. Thank you.